From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
The reason I do what I do is because I grew up in Alabama, and the first black journalist I ever knew was me. I could get a job at Sports Illustrated, and couldn't get a job in my hometown newspaper. So you will never be able to say you never met a black journalist. I do a lot of speaking on college campuses around the country, and for some reason they always want to know what's your theme, what's your topic. I usually don't ever have one, because anybody who knows me knows if it comes up, it comes out. But I actually have a theme for tonight. I actually have a challenge for tonight, and I hope you make a decision tonight. And my topic is in the form of a question. Do you want to be a thermometer, or do you want to be a thermostat? Let me put it another way. Do you want to measure the temperature, or do you want to set the temperature?
The late George E. Curry, former editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, former editor-in-chief of Emerge Magazine, author and syndicated columnist. Curry died on Saturday, August 20, 2016. He was 69. Considered the dean of black press columnists, his weekly syndicated column appeared in more than 200 African-American newspapers. Curry was a journalist's journalist. He began his journalism career at Sports Illustrated magazine, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and then the Chicago Tribune, where he became the New York bureau chief. In 2003, the National Association of Black Journalists named him Journalist of the Year. He is also on NABJ's list of most influential black journalists of the 20th century. Curry was an unapologetic steward and champion for the black press and frequently expressed a need for it in the civil rights narrative. He was deeply committed to fostering the next generation of journalists of color. He became the founding director of the St. Louis Minority Journalism Workshop in 1977. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late George E. Curry in Black America.
Emerge was a news oriented magazine that was published for 10 years, up to the year 2000. I was editor of it the last 7 years. And in fact, we have a book coming out in July called The Best of Emerge, that Ballantine Books are publishing in New York, the arm of Random House. And it has the best collection of our stories over the years. So it's very different, and quite frankly, one day, soon, I expect to start back. We got the most attention because the way we took on Clarence Thomas, we ran him as with the Ultimate Knot on his head, and then we ran 2 years later as a lawn jockey for the far right. And that's the kind of thing that if you see anything on Clarence Thomas today, people always mention that. Those are not the stories I'm most proud of. I'm most proud of our story on Kimber Smith, who was arrested 24, given a 24-year mandatory sentence for being a minor part, actually basically going with a drug dealer. I mean, the Fed said she neither sold nor used drugs, but she was, you know, very attached to this ringleader who ended up being killed. And we ran two cover stories on her and ran a couple other stories in addition to that. A couple of years ago, she was actually pardoned by Bill Clinton on his way out of office.
The late George E. Curry is best known for his editorship of the former Emerge magazine and most recently for his work as editor-in-chief for the National Newspaper Publishers Association from 2000 to 2007 and again from 2012 until last year. Born George Edward Curry on February 23, 1947 in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, his mother worked as a domestic and his father was a mechanic. His father abandoned the family when he was just 7 years old, leaving him to step into the role of the man of the house, assisting his mother in raising his three younger sisters. In 1965, he graduated high school where he was a member of the football team and sports editor of the school newspaper. In 1966, Curry moved to New York City where he worked for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in history from Knoxville College in 1970. Fulfilling a lifelong dream, he began his professional journalism career as a reporter for Sports Illustrated magazine in 1970. He was the second African-American hired by the publication. Curry died on August 20, 2016. He was 69. I first met Curry back in 1981 at NABJ National Convention in Louisville, Kentucky. The following are excerpts of interviews from 2001 and 2003.
Well, I grew up in totally segregated Tuscaloosa. I always can segregate my feelings. I tell people that in terms of the so-called integration, that there was none. I had to drink from separate water fountains, ride the back of the bus, go to separate schools, and I have very strong feelings about that. But at the same time, when I look at my black community, those black teachers or black people who were supportive, there's nothing in the world like it, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
I understand. You were a pretty good athlete back then.
Well, I did all right for a little country boy. You know, I played football, played quarterback. When the quarterback called his plays, they weren't sent in from the sideline.
Mm-hmm. And the college you attended?
Knoxville College in Tennessee. My alma mater, and I'm still on the board. I'm on the board of directors there.
And what sparked that initial interest in journalism?
Seeing the newspapers. The newspaper in my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
The only time they wrote about black people were when they were suspected of crime, committed a crime, playing football, or being an entertainer. And I thought there were so many other stories out there to be told. And since they weren't going to tell them, I decided I had to be the person to tell them. Now, what is interesting is that I could get a job. My first job out of Knoxville was at Sports Illustrated.
Mm-hmm.
So I can get a job at the largest sports magazine in the world, but couldn't get one in my hometown newspaper. So I remind them that every time I go, I should be sending them a thank you note saying thank you for not hiring me so I can go out and see the world. But that meant a lot. I mean, I could not get hired at my hometown paper. And whenever I go back, I remind them how Tuscaloosa used to be. I was back a couple of years ago, and they gave me a key to the city, and I told them that was fine, but it didn't open anything. And
mm-hmm.
Secondly, I want a key to the bank. And
no,
the combination
right.
to the vault, but they haven't done that yet.
Former editor-in-chief of Emerge magazine. Tell us about that publication.
Well, Emerge was a news oriented magazine that was published for 10 years, up to year 2000. I was editor of it the last 7 years. And in fact, we have a book coming out in July called The Best of Emerge
mm-hmm.
that Ballantine Books are publishing in New York,
mm-hmm.
the arm of a Random House. And it has the best collection of our stories over the years. So it's very different, and quite frankly, one day, soon, I expect to start back.
And what was some of the highlights of that publication?
Well, we did a lot of things that we're proud of. We got the most attention because the way we took on Clarence Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
We ran him as the Osmond knot on his head, and then we ran him 2 years later as a lawn jockey for the far right. And that's the kind of thing that if you see anything on Clarence Thomas today, people always mention that.
Mm-hmm.
But those are not the stories I'm most proud of. I'm most proud of our story on Kimber Smith,
right.
who was arrested 24 and given a 24-year mandatory sentence for being a minor part, actually basically going with a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Fed said she neither sold nor used drugs. But she was, very attached to this ringleader who ended up being killed. And we ran two cover stories on her and ran a couple other stories in addition to that. And a couple of years ago, she was actually pardoned by Bill Clinton on his way out of office. And so we were real proud of that. The other story I'm proudest of is one of my staff members that, unfortunately, I feel very strong about. My young member I had hired essentially out of college.
Mm-hmm.
Laurie had a little experience. Laurie Robinson
mm-hmm.
was raped while she was on my staff. And that really shook me up. Did the whole staff and certainly her. And she's a graduate of Spelman in Atlanta, and there was an allegation that Morehouse men had raped a Spelman woman. And only because Laurie had told me she wanted to write a book about her experience, I suggested that she go back there to her alma mater,
mm-hmm.
write about that, and then weave in her own personal experience with it. And that was just one powerful story. And those are the stories. I mean, there are a lot of stories I'm really attached to, but those are the real special ones.
You are the immediate past president of the American Society of Magazine Editors and the first African-American.
Yeah, they are.
And also not from New York.
Right, right. They kind of, you got to be from New York, you got to be white. club. Magazine's the worst newspaper in terms of diversity, but they did, in all fairness, did elect me as president. And it was indeed a high honor. And, the fact that I'm coming from a black magazine and I'm representing the whole magazine industry, so I was pleased with that.
Your current position as editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Give us a brief history of that organization and your responsibilities with them.
Well, the black press is about 176 years old, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's been around fighting against lynching and slavery and everything else. I have been here 2 years. Essentially, NNPA is a federation of more than 200 African-American newspapers,
mm-hmm.
Most of them weekly.
And essentially what I do is provide news out of Washington and international news as well for our member newspapers. And so we pretty much serve as a Washington Bureau for our newspapers.
For our audience that aren't really familiar, that are not African Americans, why is the black press, particularly your organization, and the 200 or so weeklies still viable in this country today?
Well, I wish, in having spent 33 years in journalism, most of it not in the black press, I wish that the media was doing its job and there would be no need for the black press or Hispanic press or women magazine, but the media is not doing its job. It does a terrible job. It's doing a worse job than I think when I came to business 33 years ago. So if you're going to get, in order to be well-informed, you have to read from a variety of sources in the first place.
Right.
You know, you just can't read just the Austin Statesman. You just can't read just, you know, Dallas Weekly. You just can't. You got to read from different sources. And so what the African-American perspective gives you a different look at some of the same national issues. And if you're going to be really informed, you need to read the black newspapers and go to our website, blackpressusa.com.
And these publications still having this age-old problem of finding advertisers?
Of course we do, because the black community is not valued enough by advertisers. They assume, for example, incorrectly, that if they advertise, say, in the Austin Statesman, that they don't need to talk to you. Well, that's not true. First of all, if you're advertising in the Austin Statesman, you could be talking about anybody.
Right.
So I don't know if you're talking to me. But if you advertise in the black press, we know you're interested in our audience. And we have seen studies in, when you talk about black radio, where you'd be number one in the area, and you still don't get the same advertising dollars as stations that are lower ranked. And so the black consumer has not gotten his and her a fair return.
Saw you a couple of weeks ago on C-SPAN, and I want to go over some of the questions that were put to you. First question is affirmative action controversy at the University of Michigan.
Right. I actually have a book out called The Affirmative Action Debate, which is about all sides of the issue. So, you know, the problem you have there, Hartwood University of Texas, people should be familiar about it there. Basically, it's interesting that George Bush, y'all should have kept him down there. You should have thrust him upon the nation.
Right.
On Dr. King's birthday, his actual birthday, announces that he's going against the programs at the University of Michigan, calling them a quota program, which they're not. They're not quotas. And basically what has been distorted in this whole University of Michigan case, which is now before the Supreme Court, is that everybody focuses on the 20 points that's given to an African-American automatically. What they don't focus on, you get 20 points automatically if you're a scholarship athlete there. If you come from the Upper Peninsula, you get automatically 16 points.
Right.
You come to unrepresented counties, you get extra points. If you're poor, white, because of your income, you can get 20 points. You can't get 20 points for being poor and for being black. But if you're a poor white, you can get the same 20 points. If you can do that, then why are we focusing solely and exclusively on this race? There's another 20 points you can get. The provost has a discretion to give you 20 points. And we won't even talk about the alumni preference program that George Bush went to Yale on. Now, he wasn't the brightest light around there, because his dad and granddaddy went to Yale. He got a preference for going to Yale. And so that's a real preference program. So unfortunately, the media has adopted the language of the far right, and so a lot of people really don't understand the true issues because they're so distorted. When you look at the papers there and across Texas, you see headlines say race-based admission. Well, there's no such thing as a race-based admissions, even at a black college.
Right.
You know, you don't have that at Texas Southern. You race-based admission. It's not based on your race. It's based on your qualification. It's race-conscious. Gender sensitive, but it's not based on that. When you're talking about affirmative action, you're talking about looking at qualified people and looking at their race, gender, and national origin, and along with other consideration.
I do a lot of speaking on college campuses around the country, and for some reason, they always want to know what's your theme, what's your topic. I usually don't ever have one, because anybody who knows me knows if it comes up, it comes out. But I actually have a theme for tonight. I actually have a challenge tonight, and I hope you make a decision tonight. And my topic is in the form of a question. Do you want to be a thermometer, or do you want to be a thermostat? Let me put it another way. Do you want to measure the temperature, or do you want to set the temperature? That's the choice. The problem with our profession is that we have too many people willing to measure the temperature in a newsroom to see whether there is indeed heat rising or falling, but they're not willing to be thermostats. They are not willing to be hell raisers. I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but it won't be the first time I got in trouble. It certainly won't be the last one, and I have a round trip ticket to Washington, D.C., so I'm going back tomorrow. I think something is going on in our newsroom very disturbing. Way back before even Michelle was born, the light ages, we don't use dark that way. Nathan Hare at Howard University wrote a book called The Black Anglo-Saxon. I think there's a deliberate effort in many of the newsrooms across this country today to hire black Anglo-Saxons. Homogenized black people who grew up in the suburbs, have nothing to do with black people, and afraid to go to the housing projects. I grew up in the housing project, and I know that if we don't cover these stories won't get covered. So if you're looking to be a thermometer, you came to the wrong speech tonight. I'm not saying when I say that you should be a thermostat, that you should join protesters in the street. I'm not saying that you should be unprofessional. I am saying that you should question the status quo. You must decide in your own mind whether you want to be a thermostat or a thermometer. Now, if you don't think that we need thermostats in the newsroom, look at the coverage of this kid down in Florida, Lionel Tate. This kid is 12 years old. Was arrested for killing a 6-year-old playmate. And whatever his crime, do we want to put away 12-year-old kids in prison for the rest of their life with no chance for parole? Is that what we've come to? That we say a kid who's 12 years old will try you as an adult. Now, make no mistake about it, it was a dastardly crime. The little girl died of a brutal death. She suffered a fractured skull, lacerated liver, broken rib, among other injuries. The judge said this. This was a sentence. Incarceration for your natural life. Is that an appropriate sentence? Lock him up, throw away the key. Say that we take the prosecutor's case. Say we ignore the defense case saying that basically the kids were trying to imitate what he saw wrestling on television. Say the prosecutor is absolutely right. But why is it that this kid that you're going to give life to, they offer a deal to him that if he had accepted a plea bargain, he would have gotten 3 years in a juvenile facility and 10 years probation. What's the difference? The same kid. 3 years in a juvenile facility, a life in prison with no chance of parole. We're talking about the same kid. Now, if you're a thermostat, your obligation is to stop pretending that juveniles are out of control and therefore we must try them as adults. We're the only country in the industrialized world that executes its youth. According to the Justice Department, teens of color make up about a third of a juvenile population, but people of color make up two-thirds of the population in secure juvenile facilities. That's not justice, that's just us. Since 1992, at least 42 states have passed juvenile justice laws to allow children to be tried as adults. And make no mistake about it, most of these children are people who look like you. Why is it, you must ask, if you're going to be a thermostat, that for the last 5 years, juvenile homicides have been declining, just like the overall crime rate? Yet, despite this trend, we have politicians posturing, trying to be tough on crime, so they say, acting in this irresponsible manner. They know that the crime rate for juveniles has been going down, At the same time, you have these increased calls to try kids as adults, to put them in adult prison where they'll come out, if they come out, worse than when they went in. Somebody ought to be raising these issues in these newsrooms. And how are we covered? And whether we give the same superficial coverage that everybody else gets. But let's go beyond the juvenile question. Let's look at the criminal justice system itself. You're talking about an industry that generates $30 to $40 billion a year. It is no accident that these little country towns in Texas are campaigning to have prisons in their community because they want recession-proof jobs.
You also had issue with Justice Scalia's comment about lowering the standards?
Yeah, I was in the courtroom when the oral arguments and admission cases were presented. And he had the temerity to look at the University of Michigan's lawyer and say, you know, if you're really interested in diversity, you ought to lower your standard. I just came back from Doha, Qatar, where the central command for the whole war was in Iraq. And I saw, in addition to General Brooks there, who was a brigadier general, giving the briefings every day, the sergeant major there for the whole command, Dwight Brown, African-American. We had the person who's over public affairs, the Air Force Colonel, Ray Shepard, mm-hmm. African-American. The chaplain is an African-American. Even the guy on the floor holding the microphone, reporters, African-American. They didn't have to lower their standards. But you can look at the Army and look at it, say, from top to bottom, and it hasn't always been that way, but they made tremendous progress. So you don't have to lower your standards to have quality, and I was just insulted by that comment.
You mentioned your travel to Iraq covering the war. One, why did you feel it was important that you go give another perspective of what was going on there?
Well, I went actually to Doha in Qatar, which is about 700 miles south of Baghdad, and that's where the Central Command was. What shocked me going there was the response from the people there. They were so happy to see a black person. You had more than 800 people credentialed for that. I was the only black reporter. And, I mean, there were black reporters embedded and covering other part aspects of the war. Mm-hmm. But in the Central Command, where they were making all the major news announcements, there was not another black American asking questions. And I was like, wait a minute. I'm sitting in that press room one time. Here's a guy from Finland on my right and a woman from Japan on my left. And you see all this ethnic diversity from around the world. Didn't see anybody look like us. And I think that's a strong indictment of the American media.
On the coverage of the war, of course, we want to cover the war in a way in which America will look good. But isn't it our job to question what goes on during war?
Our job is not to cover the war so that America can look good. Our job as journalists is to tell the truth. If it makes America look good, that's good. If it doesn't, too bad. That's not our job. They have PR people who do this.
Did we do that?
Yeah. I think we do a terrible job of it. And I saw a stark contrast in the skepticism of the European press, for example, the world press, actually, and then how our reporters we see here covering the war. I mean, I'm amazed, and I bet this happens down there. You see people on TV, reporters, with American flags on the lapel. Well, first of all, we know we're Americans. We don't have to carry a flag around to prove that. Secondly, it's almost like you're taking a side in the war, and you really should not be doing that. You should not be flagged. Well, you should just tell the truth and get out of the way. Let people decide for themselves. You shouldn't be cheerleading from the sideline. And that's, I fear, we're doing too much.
The immediacy of the war being brought back home, was that a good thing?
Yeah, that's a good thing. It had pros and cons. There's a big debate about whether embedded reporters were actually in-bed reporters. Mm-hmm. But by and large, it's a difficult thing. I mean, if you have a large news organization, the best you can do is have reporters embedded in different units and cover it from Doha. And you will, Stephen, then you'll get on a slice of the war. I know a lot of reporters who were embedded were talking about how limited access was. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we saw some great footage. People were able to contradict the United States version of whether there was fire coming from the Palestine Hotel when they fired upon it, killing some journalists. Mm-hmm. And so, overall, you know, I think, you know, it's mixed, but I'd rather have them there than not have them there.
Having the journalists embedded with different units of our armed forces, they only got a snapshot of what that particular unit was doing.
And that's all they could get.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's a disadvantage of it.
Okay.
But if the unit is in a good place,
mm-hmm.
you also give the report. You know, like with Baghdad, and you see the Statue of Saddam coming down, you know, they're there. They're there to capture that. And so, like I said, it is mixed. It's absolutely mixed, but I'd rather have them there than not have them there.
And being a journalist, the two journalists, American journalists that were killed during the
right
process, how did that affect you being there and knowing these were your colleagues that had fallen?
Well, actually, I had written about this in one of my, I wrote the diaries. In fact, they're on our website now, mm-hmm. BlackPressUSA.com. I forgot which day it was, but I talked about that.
I think it was day two.
Day two, okay, no better than I. And I talked about how we don't think about death as journalists. You know, you do what you want to do. This is what I've dreamed of doing. This is what I want to do since I was in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't really think about it, but I've always felt that if I died doing what I love doing, I can't think of a better way of dying.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think about it. You don't want to be dying. You don't die. I certainly don't. We will all at some point. And hope you're right with the Lord when that day comes.
Mm-hmm.
My thing was just that this is what I do. This is what I love doing. And I'd rather die doing what I love doing than live for years and years not doing what I don't like.
Did you experience any animosity from some of your colleagues because of the accessibility that you had to some of the majors and generals that were of color?
It was interesting. I got teased a lot because there were some people who had been there over a month,
okay.
And Jim Brooks had never called on them. And here I am, I'm in the briefings, I think 7 days, I'm there 8 days, I'm briefing 7 days, and he calls on me six.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a lot of teasing. In fact, I fully identify my organization, saying we're the Black Press of the United States. And so every time I was called on, so they were like, oh, George, you're a self-promoter, and you know, you're doing this, you're doing that. And I said, look, you run a large international television network. I said, people know who you are. I said, but people didn't know who I am. He said, well, they do now. I said, then you finally got the point.
Mm-hmm.
Brooks, to me, set a new standard for Black leaders.
Okay.
Generally, they come to us when they're in trouble,
mm-hmm.
after they got in trouble. If they have any major stories to announce, they go to the white press. And it's only then when they reject it that they come home. Brooks treated me the same way. He called on ABC every day. He called on CNN every day.
Mm-hmm.
He called on Fox News every day. So he put the Black press on the same level with them, not as some backseat secondary source.
The late George E. Curry, former editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, former editor-in-chief of Emerge Magazine, author and syndicated columnist. He died on Saturday, August 20th, 2016. He was 69. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.